Oh, it's such an honor, Danny, to be a part of this amazing podcast you're doing here. And it's just really cool to be talking about this book.
You know my work and you've given it a lot of thought.
That was so fun.
Yeah, it sure was, especially the quiz. Thanks for preparing that for me.
Thank you for your wonderful questions.
Best with these things, just turn into a conversation.
Yeah. Oh, I love it. Yeah, you obviously got the book.
Good on you for fighting the good fight too.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you, guys.
I love your enthusiasm. I just think it's a brilliant thing you're doing, a podcast about, you know, books, and you do a lot of great interviews, so I'm really honoured to be part of it.
Thank you for reading it in such a sensitive and intelligent way.
I so enjoy listening to the podcast. I love it. And and it does just feel like you're having a chat with your mate.
You are listening to Words and Nerds, talking to your favourite authors.
Today I welcome Alice Nelson. Alice was named one of the Sydney Morning Herald's best young Australian novelists for her first novel, The Last Sky. Her second novel, The Children's House, has been described as an elegant and finely tuned work that hums with condensed life. It is a brave and original exploration of human complexity and vulnerability, a tale of loss and reparation, both fierce and tender. If you enjoy this episode, please hit subscribe for your weekly fix of incredible authors talking about their work, or have a listen to the back catalogue of these timeless episodes with Trent Dalton, Elliot Perlman, Lexi Freeman, Jack Heath, Megan Jacobson, Kate Forsyth, Sarah Bailey, and many more. I'm your host, Danny V.
Welcome, Alice. Thank you so much for joining me to talk about your novel, The Children's House.
Oh, thanks for having me. It's lovely to be here.
I'm very much used to powering through books really quickly, but with The Children's House, it's a book you need and want to take your time reading. And it was a really fascinating read, moving from Israel to California to New York. Why was The Children's House an important story for you to tell?
Look, I think fundamentally it's based very much in a lot of personal experiences I've had in my work with refugees and asylum seekers. And I think for me, I don't sort of set out with this clear idea of the story I want to tell, but as I worked my way into this book, I found that so many of those stories and experiences and stories of loss and exile and migration, but also stories of enormous resilience and hope and love and connection, were just kind of permeating everything I was writing. So I suppose for me it was a way of telling, obviously I'm not trying to tell other people's stories, but of telling some of those experiences of exile and loss and the flip side of that on the page, and also from a personal level of processing and translating into fiction some of the complexities of my own relationships with several refugee women, and particularly their children. So, yeah, all of that found its way onto the pages of the book.
And it was an interesting book because it was really about the colliding of cultures and experiences, especially when Marina encounters Constance and her, she's a young refugee from Rwanda, and her son, Gabriel. And I just found that so interesting, the colliding of cultures and experiences, and yet their human experiences were very similar.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's one of the motifs that I'm so glad you've picked up on, because it really weaves through, which is that, you know, we meet people from these worlds that seem so disparate from our own. And of course, you know, our experiences are not comparable. But I think that there's these fundamental human elements, and particularly in Marina and Constance, you know, they're both struggling to come to terms with difficult pasts. They're both trying to find ways to be in the world and to carry on in the world, and in particular to care for children and to form connections. And, you know, their histories are so different, but in many ways they're both looking for love and belonging. And I hope that doesn't sound too trite, but I think that's such a powerful human need, and I think that In a way, it's what we're all searching for.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's why it resonated so much when I was reading it. The human experiences were the same.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that, you know, sometimes we lose sight of just how much we have in common with people. And I think, you know, one of my real concerns in this book is that, you know, as I'm sure you know, we live in these sort of terrible times in terms of our treatment of refugees and asylum seekers. And I think that a lot of that stems from just a lack of knowledge that we, you know, most of us have never met an asylum seeker or never sat down and spoken to a refugee. And I think sometimes we forget how much we have in common, and we forget to think about how we might respond if we were subject to the same sorts of traumas and forces that some of these people have had to endure. So, yeah, I really wanted to draw out those kind of commonalities and connections.
I couldn't agree with you more. I just spoke to Morten Dewar. He is a Danish picture book author, and he has got this beautiful novel called Zenobia, and it's about the refugee experiences, this one particularly the Syria crisis. And we were talking about the rhetoric in the media, and it talks about politics and numbers and makes it really kind of cold. And we need books to humanise it, because you're absolutely right. You know, these are people we should be helping.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, I feel like, you know, I'm in a position where I work with refugees and asylum seekers, so I'm constantly aware of the stories and the experiences and the challenges. But then I go to a dinner party and the conversation turns and I realise that no one there has ever had any first-hand experience, which is not a criticism, because it's not that easy to come by. But I think that, you know, books have that wonderful capacity to expand our empathetic understanding, and I hope that readers of the Children's House who may not have had a first-hand encounter with a refugee might absorb a little bit of some of the difficulties of that experience and perhaps think a little bit differently about the backstories of these people who, you're right, are not numbers there. People with kids and families and histories and losses.
And even once refugees have escaped whatever atrocities they're escaping, once they then come, like Constance, to New York, to their new home, it's still really quite isolating. And I felt that even though she was in a safer place, she still wasn't getting the kind of help that she needed to start a new life properly. Was that some of your experiences from working with refugees as well?
Yeah, absolutely. Look, my role when I worked in New York was in resettlements and working with families who had just arrived, and often just arrived from the most terrible and extreme circumstances, who'd been through things that I think most of us can barely imagine. And they'd be landed in New York, not speaking English, often not being literate, not having ever used money sometimes, this massive learning curve, which they'd have to take on while also trying to reckon with the trauma that they'd been through and try to process that. And often that manifested itself in, you know, post-traumatic stress disorder and all sorts of emotional difficulties. And I think that sometimes people don't really comprehend just how hard that adjustment is. Even though they are perhaps, you know, physically safe, they're still not emotionally safe, and it's really difficult. And I think that there's lots of great agencies and support groups out there, but there's not enough support, and there's not that kind of intensive one-on-one support that's often needed.
And I thought it was so interesting as well, the like I said before, the colliding of cultures, and I was really interested. Tell us about life in a kibbutz and how you went about your research. I just found it absolutely fascinating.
Yeah, well, I think that it is one of those little pockets of history that many people don't really know much about. I had a vague idea, but my husband was actually born in Israel, and it always fascinated me that his parents made this very active decision to not live on a kibbutz because they didn't want their children to be brought up in the communal child-rearing of the kibbutz. So I did a lot of research into that and found out that at one stage of kibbutz life, it had this very sort of socialist, communal, collective philosophy, and that extended to child rearing. So babies were actually handed over from hospital to these children's houses and brought up in this collective manner in which they didn't actually live with their parents from a very young age. And it just sort of struck me as such a strange and unusual model when, you know, we're so privileged to nuclear family, and yet he was an organisation that was sort of shattering the nuclear family and bringing these kids up in dormitories. And I wanted to know more about that, because I'm really interested in, you know, notions of children and parenting and how we care for children and how we fail them. And I think that sort of threads its way through the book too. So I did a lot of research. I visited Israel and went to various different kibbutzim and did a lot of interviews. And the thing that I found the saddest and the most interesting was that these children that had grown up in this fashion, so had never actually known what it was like to grow up with that intimate one-on-one relationship with a mother and father, still longed for it, and they still felt the lack of that, even though it was not something they had known. And I think there's a line in the book where I talk about how we long for things we've never had, perhaps more intensely because there's such a sense of loss around and such absence there. So that was definitely, it just felt like it threaded right into some of the other ideas I was exploring about people who have been through extreme experience and how they parent children. So I couldn't resist having a plot line of that in there as well.
I thought it was absolutely fascinating. And I think one part of the novel had a child describing they weren't sure whether their mother was the greatest influence in their life or the space of their mother not being there. And I thought, how powerful is that? And you're right. You know, what are the impacts of these children's houses? I just found it really fascinating.
Oh, well, that's great. Yeah, I found it fascinating too. And just getting to speak to some of the people that, you know, that quote came from a woman who had grown up in a children's house and had really not done well. And I found it interesting that some kids did okay and some kids found it fine and others really didn't. So I guess it's that thing of we all respond completely differently to the environment we're placed in. But yeah, fascinating little pocket of history there.
It is. And when you said that some kids really responded to that and some didn't, that's really interesting too, because that's, I guess, based on your own personality, because you've only had the one experience, haven't you? So it's just based on the type of person you are or have become.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's what I wanted to explore through some of the characters in the book as well, because particularly in reference to mothering and children and parenting, because there's so many people that have had, you know, dysfunctional maternal relationships, and yet some of them, like Marina, my central character, are able to kind of go on and love children and be present and attentive and form connections and be filled with empathy and love, and yet others are not able to. And I guess that also just comes down to, you know, our own personal wiring and how we respond and how we make our way in the world. I guess that's what makes life so fascinating, that we all respond so differently.
Yeah, and motherhood, that thread throughout the novel, a story about, you know, insufficient mothers or people longing to be mothers or people taking other children and mothering them, I found that so interesting and so complex as well. I think the whole, you know, idea of motherhood and the experience of motherhood is such a complex thing. So it was really nice to have it explored in various different ways.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that, you know, sometimes there's so much sort of fraught tension and conversation about motherhood in Western culture, and there's such a battleground sometimes, and there's so much judgment. And I guess I really wanted the mothers in my book that aren't able to love their children in the normal ways, I didn't want to have judgment for them. I wanted to try and give the reader some sort of window into the world of these women and the ways that their past had affected them and how that had impacted on their ability to love their children. So I hope that I managed to render it with enough complexities that readers wouldn't jump in and condemn these women. Because I think that, you know, women leaving their children or not loving their children is this sort of instant condemnation if comes to them. So I like to think that things are a little more complex and more nuanced.
Yeah, I think as you're saying that, mothers get a bit of a rough trot, don't they? The condemnation, and also you're talking about the Western world's judgment of women's choices and their mothering choices. I find that is just, it's such an incredible battleground.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it's so difficult for women, and when it's difficult enough for women who haven't been through extreme trauma, and then when you have someone whose past is kind of intruding in every aspect of the parenting of their children, it makes it even more difficult and complex. So I think that perhaps a little more tolerance and understanding and acceptance of different ways of doing things is needed.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And maybe just worrying about what you're doing and maybe not what other people are doing.
Absolutely.
I particularly enjoyed the relationship between Marina and her husband, Jacob. I thought, you know, their beautiful, careful love and the idea that marriage can't stand too much trouble. For me, it was one of the really beautiful aspects of the book, because they really deeply cared about one another.
Yeah, and look, it's funny, you know, I did a lot of reading of other novels when I was writing, and I found it was so rare to find a marriage in a novel that was really loving and beautiful and positive and full of love and care. I guess perhaps people are drawn to write about the difficult relationships or the complex ones or the ends of relationships. So in a way, it was quite lovely to be writing about this really positive, really affirming marriage of these two people who both had really difficult pasts in different ways and had found solace in each other. And I guess that's one of the themes that I really wanted to to look at. You know, there's a lot of darkness and sorrow and loss in the book, but I like to think that there's hope in the world, and that's not the only fate for us, and that we do get these second chances to find consolation. And I think that the biggest place we find that is in other people, whether it's in a partner or a friend or, you know, a kind neighbour or in a community. I think that, you know, we can find connection and we can find, you know, restoration in the world even after the most extreme loss.
You're right. It was really nice to have that, because you don't often read about marriages and they still, you know, she was still acknowledging, you know, their flaws and their differences, but at the end of the day, they had this really deep love and care for each other, which I thought, wow, this is rare to read about this in literature. So it was really quite nice.
Oh, good. Yeah, I sort of thought I've given the reader so many difficult, complex, sorrowful relationships. You know, it'd be nice for them to immerse themselves in one that has a bit more positivity and hope to it. But I think also that there's this notion in it that, as that you mentioned about a marriage not going to stand too much trouble, that both Marina and Jacob sort of carefully manage the relationship so that it does continue to be loving and positive and wonderful. And I think that that's something that's, you know, not quite the grand romance of what we imagine, but I think that it's the idea that we have to work at relationships and they don't just kind of exist in a void, that they're things that have to be managed and tended and cared for and looked after. And I think perhaps we, you know, when we've been in them for several years, perhaps we forget about that, but I think that's really important. So that's definitely present in the relationship too.
Yeah, definitely. And I think that line, a marriage can't stand too much trouble, I think that is, there's so much truth in that, and it really resonates because, you know, you're right, that's a relationship that is meant to be a central one in your life. And if it does cause you too much trouble and too much pain, then it does sort of fall apart after that.
Yeah, absolutely.
And it's so simple, you know, it was such a simple thing, but there was so much truth and it's like, yeah, that's right, that's true.
Yeah, no, it's lovely. I think when people do actually see their marriage as, you know, a work in progress, I think it's a nice way to look at it. It's something that needs caring for.
Because we've only ever gotten the stories, you know, growing up as a childhood, about the falling in love, not about the staying in love. The falling in love's the easy bit.
Yeah, absolutely. We never get to see what happens after the end of the fairy tale. That's or right. Then get the novels of terrible, tragic, you know, ends of love. And there's that great line about all great art being made on the dead body of love. So I think, you know, the middle bit doesn't get a good rap.
Yeah, I agree. I really enjoyed the Jewish rituals of Jacob's family. They were such a comfort, and it was so intriguing for me to see another's culture. Now, with, you know, your experience with your husband being from Israel, was that something that you have experienced, or did you just research these kind of aspects of that culture?
Absolutely not. My husband is from a very loving, wonderful Jewish family, and they do, you know, they're not deeply religious, but they do have this really beautiful rituals and traditions, and one of them is that Friday night meal when the family gathers and you light candles. And it's, you know, it's not for my husband's family, it's not so much about, you know, religious observance, it's about coming together at the end of the week as a family. And I just found it really interesting to look at the ways that people take rituals of religion, even though they may not actually believe in the religious side of it, and use them as a kind of framing device for their lives and use them as a kind of comfort and solace. And I think obviously that's not unique to the Jewish religion. I think that that's so important across all religions, these notions that, you know, in a world that's confusing and overwhelming and dark and terrifying, that we find frameworks to give ourselves a bit of comfort. And whether that's, you know, meditation or prayer or religious observance or Friday night dinners or whatever it might be, I think, you know, we look for structures and rituals that comfort us a bit. And I find that really interesting, and it sort of found its way into the novel.
It really was a comfort coming away from, like you said, all the loss and the trauma, and then going to this beautiful Friday night of this loving family. I thought, oh, this is what all families need to do. Like, it's so simple. You just come together once a week, and whatever your culture or religion, that, you know, that's secondary, I guess, to the part of the family coming together.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that, you know, life gets so busy and chaotic and, you know, it's so hard, but just to carve out that little space once a week is really important. And it's, you know, I know it's something that I really love in my family, and other families have different rituals, but I think we forget sometimes. I mean, I guess it's like working in a marriage, you have to work on a family as well, and if you can put some frameworks in place for that, that can be incredibly helpful.
Yeah, I agree. Now, you actually lived in the brownstone in the novel in New York. Tell us about the history of this brownstone. I imagined it and the picture on the front cover, and I'm such a big fan of New York and the architecture. Tell us how the brownstone inspired or was part of the inspiration for some of the story.
Well, it's a fascinating story because I moved to New York when I finished university. I had this idea that, you know, if you wanted to be a writer, you couldn't possibly stay in Australia and you had to go somewhere exotic and literary. So I ended up in Harlem, but not living the sort of exotic literary life that I had imagined. I ended up living with an order of nuns who also made their way into the book, and working as a caseworker with refugees. And I lived in the brownstone. And it was this house, it was owned by the nuns. It wasn't a convent per se. Brownstones have four or five floors. They're quite capacious buildings. And it was filled with people from all over the world who had somehow landed in Harlem and were working for this agency that the nuns ran. So, you know, there were Colombian human rights lawyers, and, you know, there was a Jamaican psychic who was living there, that they would just sort of take in these extraordinary people. And people stayed for a week or a month or a year or several years in my case. So it was this extraordinary house full of people from all over the world who had come, found themselves in Harlem and were doing the kind of work we were all doing. And it was just a place of story and history. And I met some of the most extraordinary people and heard some of the most amazing stories. And when I came to write the book, I found that my characters were living in the brownstone, and not with the nun, but in the book they'd actually bought it from the nuns and renovated it and were living there as a family. And it just felt really organic that that place that had been my home for so long, that I'd loved so deeply, would become the home for my characters. So there it is. And the brownstone on the cover of the book actually looks uncannily similar to the real house. So I was very thrilled and delighted when I saw that cover.
What a wonderful story, and what history that kind of place must have.
Yeah, absolutely. And I go back there often, and there's always some new fascinating person there. And it's become such a part of the neighbourhood because everyone knows the nuns, and they run soup kitchens and all sorts of other programs. So it's a real hub for the community too, which is really lovely. It's nice to have those sort of places of refuge and connection.
And we also see the projects in the novel as well. What were your experiences with the projects?
Yeah, look, when I moved to Harlem, this was back in 2000, and it was a really difficult neighbourhood, and there was a lot of disadvantage and deprivation of different sorts. And the housing projects, which are supposed to be these kind of utopian, you know, low-income housing for people, a lot of them had really become places of extreme danger and dysfunction. A lot of them were kind of controlled by gangs. There was a lot of drugs and violence, and, you know, they were really difficult, challenging places. And I remember the first time I had to go into one of the projects, you know, they had a really bad reputation. There was a lot of, at that time, they were known as murder cities because there was a lot of violence and sometimes murders there. So, yeah, places of danger, but also places where people were just trying to make their lives and were subject to all sorts of forces of intergenerational disadvantage and trauma and dysfunction, and were trying the best they could to make a life for themselves and their families. So it was really interesting to get behind all of those kind of stereotypes and those negative connotations of these housing projects, and to actually meet the people who are living there and to hear their stories, and for me to be in a position of trying to work with them to expand their horizons and to get services to support them. So, yeah, a difficult place, but also a place of tremendous story and tremendous, you know, personal histories and interests.
It really fascinates me how it was meant to be a utopia and it ended up quite the opposite. And I just wonder what went wrong from the vision to the reality of what they were trying to create.
Yeah, it's interesting, and it's so complex. And I think that there's such a complex history. The projects are, you know, primarily there's a lot of African-American communities who are dealing with all sorts of legacies of deprivation and disadvantage and racism. And I think this idea that you see it with asylum seekers too, that you just kind of put people in housing and they'll suddenly be okay. It's really so much more complex than that. And I think sometimes the people that are making the policies and organising the housing don't really know what it's like on the ground, and they don't really spend the time finding out what people need and what their own priorities are. So we often see this, and we see it with Indigenous communities in Australia too. So a really complex one with lots of good intentions, but not always playing out in the right way.
Yeah, that's right, exactly. Now, Jacob in your book says, everything is autobiographical. We never escape ourselves. I feel like from talking to you, that's quite true with your writing of this book.
Yeah, absolutely. Look, I think that, you know, I like to think that I use the fictional lens to transform my own experience, but in this novel it sort of did stay fairly close to my own biography, which I don't think is a bad thing. I think that, you know, it's been a really lovely way for me to translate some of the experiences I've had and the themes that have occupied me and the stories that I've heard onto the page. And I loved being able to use the tools of fiction for that. But yeah, you're absolutely right. It did stay fairly close to the bone.
I loved how you just brought all these ideas that seemed separate, but brought them just all together. And so they were all weaving together to create this one story. That was probably my favourite part of the story.
Oh, thank you. And I guess it's like a life, you know, there's so many threads and they all sort of weave into a kind of tapestry, and that's what I want to reflect in the book. So I hope that I've done it in a cohesive way.
And what was your writing process for a book like this? Because there are so many threads and it is quite a complex tale of many different personal stories. So how did you go about writing it, and what was your process?
A bit of a nightmare, actually. Someone asked me if I'd sort of planned the book from beginning to end, and I remember thinking, God, I wish I could have done that because it would have made it a lot easier. But it was a difficult one to write because there were so many different threads to it, and, you know, I could write sort of each section of the plot, but then weaving them together I found incredibly difficult, and I did a lot of cutting and lots of bits of the story got chopped out and put back in and taken back out again. And I found it really hard to weave them together and to not have one element overbalance the others, and to have them be different enough to be interesting and yet to still have all those sort of echoes and connections and symmetries that made them feel like they were part of a cohesive whole. So it was a really difficult, fraught process. I mean, it was wonderful too, and I think that process of discovery is part of the joy of writing for me. But yes, it was a tough one to write. So it's very nice to actually see it in its final form now and to know that I can't actually do anything else to it.
And isn't it funny? I mean, on the front, Stephanie Bishop describes the novel as an elegant and finely tuned work that hums with condensed life. And you were talking about the writing process being, you know, fraught and nightmarish. And does it kind of blow your mind a bit that it went from that to this elegant and finely tuned piece of work?
Yeah, absolutely, and that's such a lovely quote. But I think that the humming with condensed life bit was where I had all the problems, because there was so much life I was trying to fit into the book. So nice to think of it humming away there. But yeah, look, it's lovely to feel that I achieved some of my aims, and to hear back from readers that they did love all those different strands, and they did feel that they all kind of found their place in the overall picture of the book. And yeah, a little bit surreal given, you know, thinking of myself a year ago sitting at my desk tearing up my hair and wondering how on earth I'd ever get this book to cohere. So I guess you need to have that sort of faith in yourself and the process and trust that you'll find a way through. So hopefully when I get to that stage in my next book, I'll be able to remember that and remember that I could do it, and hopefully it won't be so difficult this time around.
And what was your publishing process like, or your publishing journey? I really like to hear people's stories because I don't think I've heard two the same.
Yeah, look, mine, I mean, it's actually a dream process, and which is not always the case. So I feel incredibly lucky, and I was able to meet with a few publishers, and I met with Meredith Kerner from Penguin Random House, and it was so lovely because it was just that thing of you meet someone, you immediately know that they've understood what you're trying to do with the book and that they've got it on a really deep level. And Meredith certainly got it in a big way, and that's really all through our working relationship and the editing and publishing process. It's just been so lovely to feel that I found a home for the book where it's really understood and where there wasn't, you know, pressure to make it more commercial or to give it a happy ending or any of those sort of external pressures. And, you know, I've just felt like it's been a really lovely collaborative process. I had a brilliant editor who, you know, it was a demanding editing process, but I definitely feel like it made the book better. And even just the whole process of cover design and writing the blurb and the marketing, it was really collaborative. You know, of course, it's a bit nerve-wracking and a bit scary too, but I felt really supported and really understood, and I'm incredibly grateful to the wonderful team I've had around me.
I love the cover too. I mean, just touching on the cover, it's just such a beautiful cover, and it just tells so much of the story, just with the brownstone and little Gabriel out the front. I just thought it was gorgeous.
Oh, good. Yeah, I absolutely loved it. And, you know, it was a really hard book to find a cover for because, you know, there are so many different plot elements, and there was lots of different thinking about should it be a more abstract colour or more symbolic one. But I guess in the end we all decided that, you know, that little child was really at the heart of the novel, so to try and have some representation of him on the cover. And then the brownstone, which is also, you know, another huge element of the novel. So to be able to get them both, you know, the little boy and the brownstone there in such a beautiful rendering was just lovely. When I first saw that one, you know, my heart, you know, missed a bit because it was so beautiful and it felt so right for the book.
And it does. It does tell a story, I think. You know, it tells a story about the brownstone and Gabriel's journey in New York and being in Harlem. So I think it does kind of tell that story as well.
Yeah, and I love the way, you know, the designer talked about it sort of inviting the reader to rush up the steps of the brownstone as Gabriel's doing on the cover. And I love that idea that it's a kind of invitation to step into the story.
I like that. You said you have a second book underway. Is that what is next for you? And can you tell us anything about that, or is it a secret?
Well, it's not a secret, but my process is so such that I never really know what the story is until I'm halfway or more through it. But I do know I had this extraordinary experience last year where I spent some time on a friend's coffee plantation in southern India. And, you know, once again, I found myself in this incredible place of stories and histories and kind of colliding experiences. And, you know, for a writer, I just couldn't stop taking out my notebook. So the novel is set on that coffee plantation in the mountains of Tamil Nadu, and I'm not entirely sure how the story will spin out, but I think it will be, there's definitely an element of a love story in there, and that thing again of looking at different experiences and stories and trying to weave them together, hopefully in a slightly less painful and difficult way than in the children's house.
I love how the setting is so significant in this new novel as it was in the children's house as well.
Yeah, definitely. Look, I think that when I look at the common threads, it's absolutely that finding that place, that kind of fascinating and compelling place that inhabits your dreams. And certainly India has been doing that for me of late. So I think that's when you know that the energy's there and you need to write it. So that's also a great excuse to go back for a research trip.
I hear this a lot. Wonderful. That's the secret, isn't it? Well, thank you so much, Alice. It's been an absolute pleasure speaking to you, and I really enjoyed the book. It was refreshing for me to read a book with such a different pace as I think this book demands, but it was a lovely, rich read, and I just loved the characters and, of course, the setting. And thank you for writing it.
Oh, thank you so much. Thank you for reading it in such a sensitive and intelligent way. It's lovely.
You are listening to Words and Nerds, talking to your favourite authors.